You know, I think the really sad thing for Morgan Freeman is that answering machines, like not everybody has it. Yeah, not everybody has an outgoing. I mean, you have an outgoing message on your phone, but it's not really the same as like when that shit was public.
Oh, what? When he used to have an outgoing message? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that if he had never made his bones in the movies or during that fantastic stint with Electric Company in the 70s.
He could have just rented himself out to people.
He could have just made tapes.
Yeah. He could like, just hoard himself out as a you know,
answering machine.
I'm glad you called.
Yeah.
But we're right, not home.
Yeah, well, something
great.
Like that.
That sounds like a great... You know what? You probably could do some sort of novelty, like... back sales kind of thing. No, I do like
novelty back sales.
No. Like I don't
selling backs.
Here we go again.
But only novelty backs. The trick backs.
No. Novelty. Like if you're looking back. I don't know. I don't know
okay.
what I'm saying.
Oh sure.
What I do know is that we're sitting in the dark, only lighted by three electronic devices and a television screen, and it sort of feels like it's going to be like a horror movie, like one of these.
It's like ambient, but spooky ambient.
Yes.
Yeah, usually we have a little bit of mood lighting, and right now it's just bad mood lighting.
Yeah, it's a different kind of mood lighting.
Isn't that a CCR song?
Isn't that probably. wasn't that a show with Cybill Shepherd and Bruce Willis in the 80s?
That was, though, the Will There, Won't They show.
Yeah, not mood lighting. Not moonlighting.
Mood lighting. Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd. I don't... All right, I'm Shane.
Ryan.
I'm Kevin.
And I guess I'm Mark.
Somebody likes it.
In
semi-music news.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, it's technically music news. It's just wacky music news. Quincy Jones called the Beatles no-playing motherfuckers in an uninhibited new interview on AV Club. And it is chock full of goodness.
Yeah, that's not even like the most shocking thing in the article.
Uh-uh.
The headline is Quincy Jones, the Beatles were, quote, the worst musicians in the world.
Yeah.
And then it goes on from there with such fun little anecdotes. As Jones, a self-proclaimed quote-unquote dog, went out to dinner with Ivanka Trump about 10 years ago, an event he describes as a quote-unquote date. Whether she thought as much is unclear.
Yeah.
I just read a Quincy Jones looks back retrospective, I think in Esquire or GQ a couple of weeks ago.
He's 84 and he doesn't give a shit anymore. Here's another bullet point. Bono is cool and lets Jones stay at his castle when he is in Ireland, but U2 sucks now. And I can't really fault him for that one.
No.
But the one that really stuck out for me...
Was the Beatles suck? Were the shittiest musicians?
Even more than that, Marlon Brando and Richard Pryor had sex.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he says that too. And he also says that he knows who killed Kennedy.
He also says he knows who killed Kennedy and it was the Chicago mob.
Just not holding back on any front.
But,
right. When you get to the Marlon Brando, Richard Pryor part of it, that's the point where you're just like, Quincy, honey, buddy,
so this
you
is
doing all right?
Yeah, this is the pull quote that they gave. They gave him like a full paragraph. They were of the Beatles. They were no playing motherfuckers. Paul was the worst bass player I ever heard. And Ringo... Don't even talk about it. I remember once we were in the studio with George Martin, and Ringo had taken 3 hours for a 4-bar thing he was trying to fix on a song. He couldn't get it. We said, mate, why don't you get some lager and lime, some shepherd's pie, and take an hour and a half and relax a little bit. So he did, and we called Ronnie Varell, a jazz drummer. Ronnie came in for 15 minutes and tore it up. Ringo comes back and says, George, can you play it back for me one more time? So George did, and Ringo says, that didn't sound so bad. And I said, yeah, motherfucker, because it ain't you. Great guy, though.
Yeah, no, it is full on. You know, I mean, the thing is like you get to a certain age, right? And there is, like, I think most people seem to be in agreement that it's like when you get to a certain certain stage as a senior citizen, you can just say whatever crazy thing pops into your head at any time. But it's not always public interview that goes on.
Well, also if you're self-aggrandizing in your, and you're Quincy Jones, is it self-aggrandizement in the way that it is with normal people? I mean, look at the life that motherfucker has lived.
He has the goods. Like he did it.
But at the same time, that's where the 84-year-old comes out when the shit just comes out of old people's mouths.
Well, it just reminds me of the one time I've been to a Seder, like a Passover Seder. It was my girlfriend's best friend was Jewish, and so I got invited along to this thing. And her grandfather, who was probably in his late 80s, was sitting at the head of the table, and he'd just fart and just smile, like not even really acknowledge it, just didn't really care.
I think that's kind of similar to what he just said there about the Beatles.
Fart. I mean, let's be honest. Like at that stage of your life, that's kind of what your life is.
Yeah,
like it's just a fart.
You know, like he says,
didn't seem bothered.
He's saying like about
to conceal it.
He doesn't care. Like at this point, if you go back and you read the article that I read, he's talking about like how he's still a horn dog at 84 years old, and the person's like, "Do you think you're, you know?" Sexual desire will ever die down a little bit. He goes, no, never. Who are you talking about? Not me.
Yeah, well.
28 Grammy Awards and co-produced Michael Jackson's best-selling records.
Yeah, and so. Co-wrote, I would say, on those, even though, you know, like it's co-production. I mean, he did say some really interesting things in that interview, but some of it you're just like, what is coming out of your mouth? Oh, and by the way, apparently, based on what the interviewer of... I think it was Esquire, that person said that his favorite word is motherfucker, so every other word, you know.
The last sentence in the article is, quote, rock ain't nothing but a white version of rhythm and blues, motherfucker.
Yeah, he likes motherfucker, which is great, which is a great word.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, it's a special treat, so if you get a chance... The original interview was in Vulture magazine, and it is a...
Yeah, the summation is in AV Club.
Yeah, it's a special walk down, dropping bomb bomb lane.
The dude deserves props, you know, like, period, like, beyond belief. Like, but at the same time, you got to admit, like, that's just a little bit odd.
So you know who doesn't deserve props? Genesis circa 1972.
I was going to say Mark
for bringing us this.
Well, the funny thing was, it's like, so, okay, last week, welcome back, Shane, by the way. Last week, we covered the Josh Rouse record 1972. In it, it was like kind of an homage to songs that were popular the year of his birth. And then Mark says, pipes up at the end of the show, and we said, hey, why don't you do next week? And he says, well, I'm going to pick a record that actually came out in 1972, and then it was this.
Yeah, that's very different. By the way, I was going to say this. That was that Josh. It was good that I wasn't here because that record was my soundtrack for a 4-month tour I did a couple years ago. I was extremely familiar with it inside and out, so it kind of worked out well that I wasn't.
I dug it. I was bummed you weren't here to talk about it.
Yeah, I loved it a lot. That one and the one before Derek and I, that was our jams. But Genesis, Mark.
What's this record called, Mark?
Foxtrot.
This is Foxtrot. This is Genesis' fourth studio LP. Came out in 1972, as Kevin mentioned.
Yeah.
A collection of six lovely songs.
But how long is the album?
50 minutes. 50-minute long.
Yeah, that's like...
Well, I was racing against the clock to finish the thing, and... I look at my Spotify, I'm like, oh, I'm on the last song. Well, guess what, pal? That last song is 23 minutes and 5 seconds long.
23 minutes long. It's seven movements, 23 minutes. In my house, if something has seven movements in the last 23 minutes, I'm lighting a match afterwards.
No, or you're calling a doctor who like could take a kid into the hospital.
That's right.
Yeah. I'll tell you what it made me think of was like, years ago, doing college radio, back in those days, it was like if anybody was like doing a shift at the college radio station, and if it was a classic rock, because the format was all over the road, like, but if it was a classic rock section, and somebody wanted to put on a record, but didn't really want to attend to what they were doing, they would always like Inagata De Vita was the go-to like 19-minute. Like, you could put that on.
Yes or something.
Or they could have put this one on and had a couple more.
Exactly.
If they want to, like, make out with their girlfriend, like, get snuck up in there.
Do half a pack of smokes or whatever. Like, so 23 minutes. Like, not screwing around. Well, maybe.
There's a lot of screwing around on this record.
Yeah. There's a lot of screwing around on this record.
So I want to say I might have a little bit different response to this record than you guys are going to assume. And that is, I didn't hate this record.
There's one song on it that I actually like.
Is it Timetable, the second one?
No.
Because that one I really liked. So
it's Horizons.
I think that one I kind of like.
Even though I kind of like that, it does sound like it should be played during a slideshow at a funeral.
Yeah, well, I like Timetable, the second song, even though it sounds... Oh, there might be one of two things, like contrasting that with the fucking horrific nonsense of the first song on the record. But also, it has a lot of talking about, like Sir Lancelot and chivalry.
Oh, the last couple of days in my car, it's been a fucking Ren Faire.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I had a similar note in my notes that it seems like they were just doing a lot of minstrel music.
This basically is what Gary Gygax was listening to in Wisconsin when he was dreaming up the rules to fucking Dungeons and Dragons. I swear to God.
By the way,
I love that you know the name of that guy.
This shit is the fairies and elves that Bill Hicks used to talk about. Like, this is that kooky early 70s.
Well,
British Islands stuff.
Yeah, but it's that stuff combined with so this is the thing I was gonna say. I didn't hate this record more than if I were like playing a kazoo in my dog's face, like how that dog would be like, what is happening here? That's kind of what I felt like for most of this record.
You know, you guys
I was just confused by it.
That's a fair response.
That is fair. Yeah. You know, you guys know that I like to say a positive thing or two about everything if I can.
A what thing or two?
A positive thing or two. Get that
if
out of the
can.
Way
sure.
if I can. So, you know, these guys know how to play their instruments. They're hitting notes. I can't necessarily tell if they're the right notes or not, because like, whatever. But also, this record doesn't suck as bad as Styx, which it a little bit reminded me of, like, Styx being like an 80s bloated prog.
Mr. Roboto?
Mr.
Record?
Kilroy?
Kilroy
was here.
Yeah. No, it did not suck as bad as that.
So, one thing that this album reminded me of is something that gets easily glossed over because of his later career. Phil Collins is really talented drummer.
He is.
I will say this.
After that first song, I hated his drumming on that first song, but I think that's
really, I loved the drumming.
Yeah, I could see you saying that. Well, I think it was more that I didn't like the time, like shifting time signatures.
You're not a big fan of 9/8?
Not necessarily.
It's really busy. But I will say when that first song came on, I was like, oh, they let Phil Collins sing a song. And like, no, he just sounds a lot like Peter Gabriel.
No, he was singing on that, too.
Was he?
He was singing on that record.
Well, a lot of this, Peter
Gabriel. They do sound a lot alike.
They sound a lot alike,
I think
Peter Gabriel, or...
I'm pretty sure he sang on this record.
Phil Collins' era Genesis sounds a lot like Peter Gabriel.
Early Genesis, or early Phil Collins Genesis stuff does, and that's because Phil Collins had to step in and
you know, I could be wrong about that, because I know, like, for most of this record it was Peter Gabriel, but I thought there were at least one or two songs that Phil Collins sang on.
They just kind of sound alike.
Yeah. No, they definitely sound alike.
Peter Gabriel.
What's up?
As far as I know, this is all
it
Peter
was.
Gabriel,
I thought there was one or two songs that were Phil Collins, but I mean, like,
this record made me long for the halcyon days of Phil Collins era Genesis.
Oh, we'll have a long discussion about that in a second.
Yeah.
But since we're here right now, why don't we hear a little bit of one of these?
Mark, can we play just, you know, 17, 18 minutes of
normally we'd give you like 30 to 60 seconds, but I mean, like, if it's going to be like comparative,
sure. You're all going to want to get a soda.
Eight, 9 minutes.
So normally we'll play three cuts in a normal episode of this podcast, right? So rather than three individual cuts, I thought maybe, hey, we could just play three cuts off that one song.
No, seriously.
You'd still only get like a small sampling of right. What's going on there.
You'd like less than half of the movements.
That's such a fucking great idea. Do you really want to do that?
Well, I do actually want to play two cuts off of that unless there's objections.
I think that's a great idea, but it's so funny. Like what? Because that there, you know, how many movements? Seven movements.
Yeah,
and they all really sound a lot different.
Well, I mean, I was tempted to start us off with "Watcher of the Skies," which was the first single from this album. But then Shane, you've kind of maybe swayed me a little bit, saying that you like "Timetable." So
I did. I like that. I did like that song.
Yeah. Why don't we listen to "Timetable" then?
A carved oak table tells a tale. Times when kings and queens sipped wine from goblets gold, and the brave would lead their ladies from out the room to arms cool. A time of valor and legends born, a time when honor meant much more to a man. Strive to tell right from wrong, through lance and sword. Why can we never be sure till we die, or have killed for an answer?
I mean, don't get me wrong, it's not my most favorite song in the world, but there are interesting, pretty, that like things that I like about 70s soft rock in chordal wise and stuff like that in that song. I think it's a pretty song, and it's a song. Like there's most of this album,
okay,
they're not songs.
It is a song. Whereas my chief complaint about a lot of this record is like, they'll just take one little musical idea for like five bars and then completely change it up and play something.
Right. Right. I like the five bar thing because, yeah, I'm just like, it feels like you're watching like a really fast cut, like science fiction movie right now. Like, what is going on? Like a Transformers movie or something. Yeah.
Like every now and then, like I would latch on to a little something they're doing, and sure enough, they'd yank the rug out from under me and just start doing something completely fucking different, but not in that song. You are right. That is an actual song.
I just think the melody's pretty. Like, I think the lyrics are nonsensical and, you know,
kings and queens
and Lancelots and, you know, serfs and whatever have you from that period of time. I didn't say serfs, but
yeah,
unless it's like, hey, let's go surfing, because it is pretty much, it's kind of like the Beach Boys, I guess.
Well, you know,
surfs up now.
That sounds better than Surfing Santa, which we talked about.
And I don't know that it is better than Surfing Santa in a certain way.
Surfing Santa might be more entertaining.
Can you imagine if, like, you were going down, like, to hit the waves, like, in 1972, like, go running down there, and some dude's like, check out my new surf music, and it's like, like harpsichord. You don't know. Right. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they were playing to surfers in 1972.
No, they were playing to Gary Gygax writing the rules for Dungeons and Dragons sitting in Wisconsin. Like,
so did you guys read the Wikipedia about the making of this record?
Yes.
They kept losing producers, you know, because they were arguing about what is a good song, and like, you got me, dude. Like,
well, I mean,
well, if that's the best you could come up with.
Some of the reactions from band members, too, you know, weren't entirely positive about the way that this album was put together. You know, just the feeling like certain songs were rushed, or
no pun intended, with the word rush.
Well, I hear you, a prog joke, but also
prog humor.
We didn't talk about Rush.
We didn't talk about that they finally broke up. Yeah. Like, it's out of sheer exhaustion. Yeah, they did.
Rushed it.
Uh huh. So so the deal is that at least at one point during the recording of this record, there was a track actually being laid down, like the chorus was being laid down or whatnot. No, it was the middle of a track, and Peter Gabriel was writing another part of the song while the first part of the song was happening. Like, there was, like, that's how rushed some of it actually was, according to those who were there.
Well, and I guess it only took them like a month or so, which it's kind of reminded me a little of that, like, kind of Steely Dan, like, pursuit of perfection in the studio kind of situation. And they would take forever.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem precise to me, anyway.
I think they recorded this in, like, August of 72, and it was out by, like, November.
Yeah.
Which is quick.
That's about how long it takes to listen to it.
No shit, man.
Well, some of the songs, certainly. So what do you guys think? Do you want to dig into this opus of Supper's Ready?
Yeah, I have a theory on Supper's Ready, by the way.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, my theory is that if you start the song at the beginning, you can go make dinner, and by the time the song is over, yeah, your dinner's ready.
To eat?
Yeah, sure.
Well, and I was also going to maybe get into the difference between dinner and supper in England, because supper is actually something that you have after dinner.
Oh, well, yeah, let's break that down.
Yeah.
Well, I will say this, that I didn't realize it was seven different movements, and I kept thinking the album was over, and I'd go look at my phone, and I'm like, shit, that song's only halfway done. So
I just want to read a little bit about the guy that I saw his quote when he said that it's like Supper's Ready is the undisputed masterpiece.
You mentioned that when you got here, and I dispute it.
Yes, as do I. So whoever people have written their Wikipedia page, never seen people get more into details. Unsurprisingly,
it's a little bit like Wikipedia editing wars.
Yeah. Well, like, again, I mean, people that listen to prog rock like this are into details, not, you know, feel, as it were. So here's a couple of things. In his review for Sounds magazine, Jerry Gilbert thought Genesis, quote, almost achieved the perfect album, quote. Okay.
Man, I bet Quincy Jones would have had a field day with this sucker.
Yeah. here's another one that I actually feel he kind of hit the nail on the head. Rich Arrowgood in the Philadelphia Daily News read, quote, Genesis still has trouble putting songs together. That's all I need to hear about that one.
It's accurate.
But the guy that wrote that, getting back to this, the guy that wrote the that, you know, undisputed classic line, he rates this guy, Stephen Thomas Erlewine, in his review for AllMusic, rates the album 5 stars out of 5. No. He considers Foxtrot being the first time that Genesis attacked like a rock band, playing with visceral power. They consider this a positive change, commenting that Genesis has grown muscle without abandoning the whimsy, and concluding this is the rare art rock album that excels at both the art and the rock.
Do you think that there's anybody in England, anybody that just went, what the hell is going on? There are a whole bunch of these bands. None of them sound like they're ever getting to the point.
Well,
like,
and to touch on that, actually, this was not a big album for
it was like a
in England.
Tier
it just it did not
it
do
sold
well for
okay
them.
In England, but apparently they were big in Italy at the
up
time.
To
right.
number 12
in Belgium.
Yeah,
I mean Belgium.
It's not,
and
it's
surprisingly
not
didn't get much
a
airplay
blockbuster
in the
album
States.
For England.
Well, yeah. do you think it's like sort of like a bizarre world kind of punk thing, like where, you know, like you had people like breaking outside of the mainstream or whatever, like gravitating toward punk and proto punk. And people gravitating outside the mainstream. I mean, I'm talking about in 71, 72.
I've been thinking about that this week. Like, what is it about Prague that made it like an actual musical force, you know, and to some extent commercial force there for a while? And I think it's like people wanting to get like the sort of higher society like experience of being into classical music, but they wanted to have their rock at the same time. And so this idea of, like, you know, breaking stuff up into movements and talking about, you know, all this bizarre forest poetry or whatever.
I mean, I guess I was drawing a similar parallel, but maybe to a lot of jazz, just in the way that they compose things or don't compose things.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of noodling going on in this.
A lot of noodling.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and to be fair, I mean, you know, the album was the dominant music distribution method of the day, and so people, the audience was this
by,
was
by
not
album,
a,
you mean LP like vinyl,
yeah,
yeah,
the yes, the long playing record, like, mm-hmm. so folks were They were, you know, this is not a short story reading crowd. This is, they're in for the novel. And so in this case, the novel is
well,
is
and that
to evolve,
format, you know, lends
it's
itself
like the Lord
to,
of the Rings
to you know, doing like a comparative type of thing, like a novel.
Sounds like it was written in the Shire.
Yeah.
Well, Lord of the Rings is three novels, but that's sort of what it felt like listening to that Ready for Supper or whatever. Here's Supper. What's
Supper's
up with
ready.
Supper?
Shall we listen to a little piece of this?
Sure,
like,
yeah.
I don't think
service
that
and entree.
I mean, my opinion of this of Supper's Ready. This is the 23-minute song that basically makes up the entire second half of the LP, second side of the LP. They're like as a whole, yeah. It's just a cluster, and
it's just confusing.
It's very confusing. But like I just found little bits and pieces out of certain sections of this that I could pick out and think, man, that was really good. And
that'd be cool if they made that into a whole song and just like, you know, 3.5 minutes of that and then moved on to the next thing.
Sure, sure. Well, let's just take a little bit of a sample from the second section of this.
Movement number two.
Movement number two, titled The Guaranteed Eternal Sanctuary Man. How about that? I played,
that was
about a minute and a half for
was,
you?
That was one of the parts that I enjoyed.
Yeah.
Of that.
All right. Well,
song.
Good. We found a nugget there in the middle of everything. That Mellotron, by the way, they picked up secondhand from King Crimson. And it's
well,
name,
there you go.
It's Shane's
favorite.
Its name is Black Bitch because it was notorious for breaking down in just all the wrong times.
There's a passage in a Zeppelin song, and I can't remember which one right now, but that kind of reminds me of that a little bit. And this record reminded me like all the worst parts of Led Zeppelin.
If they only
did that.
It's like, yeah. Where did Jimmy Page go?
Yeah, he's up at the Shire.
Now, talk about a band that's sung often about Lord of the Rings. Like,
it's a Mordor.
Ramelon.
I met a girl so fair.
Yes. Yeah. Get your ringtones, everybody.
So, one thing that I found kind of interesting about Foxtrot and then basically the supporting shows that they started doing for this was Genesis were known as kind of just this static band. They were very intense in their playing, so they would all sit in chairs and stuff while they played, and Gabriel would be the one person standing, but he was extremely shy, so he would tend to kind of stand in the shadows. When Foxtrot came out, I need to look up this guy's name. Paul Conroy at Charisma Records thought it would be a great idea if somebody dressed up in a red dress and a fox mask.
Yeah.
And got on stage while they played the songs.
Yeah.
And Peter Gabriel said, well, that's a fantastic fucking idea. And I think it should be me because, you know, that would make me a star if, you know, if I did this. So this is kind of what launched Peter Gabriel's whole performance art.
Yeah,
like career.
Yeah,
this
think it
launched
cool.
it.
Well, and you can make the argument that up until that point, there was a certain amount of Peter Gabriel's art. Like, I think he always had these artistic tendencies, like obviously, but you know, his big bold move coming into this record was shaving a sand trap reverse divot in his head,
right?
That became like one of the stupidest haircuts in rock history.
What?
Yeah,
like,
yeah no,
yeah,
yeah,
no.
I haven't seen this. Like,
oh my god, it's
shit.
Amazing. Yeah.
Wait, what was it? I haven't seen this.
He looks like he should be in a home.
I'll find you a picture of it, but
like a reverse widow's peak, I guess.
Kind of, except worse. Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I mean, it worked for them. This set them apart from, I don't know, however many other prog rock bands were.
How did Derek Trucks end up in that band?
That
like all of a sudden, like now I know that this was actually like Spinal Tap was based on a true story.
Well, I was gonna say, yeah, that whole like fox mask stunt sounds like it could be right out of Spinal Tap.
Oh no, dude, this entire album reminds me of Stonehenge.
Yeah,
yeah, like dancing dwarves and
well, everything about.
I mean, it's certain that they got a lot of those influences,
artistic
from
inspiration,
this era of music. Yeah. But I mean, it worked for them. They doubled their regular intake for gigs once they started doing this stuff. And yeah.
Well, and the impression that I got just from doing some of the reading was that it sounded like, you know, that the Italians really fell in love with this record. And so when they toured Italy, they were seeing crowds the size that they weren't used to seeing before. And it kind of opened their eyes to making money on the road. So. All right, how are we doing? Are we to that point?
Why don't we take a break?
Okay.
Go to the intermission?
Yeah, I think it's intermission time. I'll just play. I'll play the bumper music. You don't have to do
good,
it.
It's not
Bobby
as tech, not as
funk
good
version.
Yeah. Here we go.
It's Michael Winslow. Hey now. So, welcome to the middle of the show. This is the part of the show where we take an abrupt departure from what we've been haranguing over the first several minutes. We talk about something a little bit different. In this case, abrupt departure, we're going to talk a little bit. Shane made the suggestion off mic that maybe it'd be fun to delve into some... There's so many other areas of Genesis. I am going to choose one of those. I'm not going to choose one of the ones he probably thinks I'm going to choose. So we're going to take a turn. We're going to take a stroll down memory lane to Genesis eponymous 1983 LP called Genesis by definition. And
hits the eponymous.
Hits the eponymous. And yeah. And the a single off that track or off that record called Mama. Can't you feel my heart? Oh, can't you feel my heart? Can't you feel my heart? Oh. Lyrically, if you listen to that track, you probably figured out he's not talking about his mama.
Oh.
No.
Talking about a little mama?
I'm talking about a mama of the evening, so to speak.
Yeah.
And the inspiration for the laugh in that track is lifted from the Grandmaster Flash song, The Message. So, all
right. For real.
Yeah, so it's a rap thing, like... And it, like, all the Ryan was making James Brown comments while I was playing, I was like, it's really not that far off from that.
We'll see, there you go.
Yeah. But it's a very 80s video. It's a very early MTV video.
I don't know.
Yeah,
it's very early 80s, but it was also like a horror movie.
It's pretty dark.
It was affecting.
They're in like a abandoned warehouse or something. And
it just looked like a motel.
Just slow,
like
there were these crane
motel or bordello
that, like, circled
and,
it.
Yeah. You know, Cuba or something.
Dude, I like that song a lot.
It's a pretty good song. So around this time, Genesis was not that bad, which I probably wouldn't admit in front of everybody, but I guess I just did. Like Abacab, they had a couple songs.
What was the song like? That's All, I think.
Yeah, it's called That Song.
Yeah, I got the impression.
That song is fucking Again, disturbing song.
I got the impression, Shane, that maybe what you thought would be the best juxtaposition would be like trot out some Sussudio shit, but I was like, no. I think like
they got
we
kind
should
of stupider as the decade went on.
Well, no, sure. they got more pop as it went on.
Well, and certainly like more saccharine. Like there was no danger in some of those tracks.
No.
Like,
so
later.
I mean,
there was danger record. In that track.
Yeah, there's danger.
That was a great song.
Off
I'm glad
same
you played
record,
that.
There was a song that I really liked that I went back and looked up while that was playing, and I do genuinely love that, like that song. I won't say I love it, but I definitely like it. But I remember it, like this video was like kind of racist, and but it was a
this
song.
Video? This video from, that we just
no,
watched,
Illegal Alien.
Illegal Alien is from the same yeah. record. So I went back and looked at the lyrics, and like the lyrics are actually not bad.
I don't remember this
it's
song.
It's talking about
illegal
how hard
alien.
It is to like be an illegal alien. Like
I think the racist part of it was
what
that
year
he,
did this album
he
come
gets
out?
Into 83? Character.
The video. It's the video where yeah. like. Phil Collins dresses up as a Mexican person.
And he sings it in character, too. Yeah,
yeah.
I think it's a little...
It's a, anyway, it's worth checking
it's,
out at
it's
some
at
point,
best
but,
campy.
Yeah, yeah, but it's a catchy yeah. song.
At best. I yeah. know what song you're talking about. Yeah. Now that I think about it, yeah, that's one you're not going to want on your resume when you die.
Well, looking at the lyrics...
Doesn't
like
matter looking at the lyrics.
No, it's actually... They're well put together or whatever, but it's so overshadowed by the video.
Well,
anyway,
I mean, this
I dug that.
This was just so there was nothing. I love this song. I remember
I really like.
I remember putting my Walkman yeah. on and jamming
I've
out.
Never
to this
heard
song.
It before. I've never heard this song in
no
my
kidding.
Life.
No kidding. Yeah, lyrically, like one of the things that I forgot that I like about this era of certain Genesis songs that were like that really sort of were in the public consciousness at that time was like his like. His singing is pretty spare. Like he's obviously, he feels comfortable sort of waiting out.
He's
measures.
A great like, singer. That's
timing.
That's just feel. It's not just his like, timing too. He sings like, and he's got the chops to do it. He's a really good singer,
mm-hmm.
and he really shows it off in that song. And you can hear it later. Like the guy knows how to sing. And you're right. Like he does. He plays to the beat because I think maybe because he's a drummer. Like he plays to the beat of the drums. Like in a And that makes it a little more sparse. Like, in this period of time, this is the period of time where, like he was writing...
In the Air Tonight, I think.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is a period of time where In the Air Tonight, That's All, this song, Mama, which I've never heard before. Like, very all three of those, very disturbing, like, songs. Like,
right. Well, and a lot, and at least a couple of those that you just mentioned, like, with
all
that sort of canned... Like dangerous sounding drums, and
not canned. I can tell you how they made them. Those they
okay, keep,
like those are, that was how that it sounds canned. We're used to it now. So there's a thing called like it's gated reverb, and that actually was pretty much started through Phil Collins, and it was like it was an accident that made it sound really super compressed and really punchy, but he applied that. And it was from him, I think, in The Air Tonight. And they started applying it to like tom drums, like the for those of you that don't know
sure.
drum kits,
right.
Like the big smashy drums. That
was really erudite.
Yeah, I know.
Shane's moving his arms.
Yeah,
too.
I know. I'm like show you guys how you play drums.
Well, no, it sounds a little like what Prince was doing.
That's all gated reverb. Like yeah. all of the drums in the 80s, that all came out of Phil Collins initially.
Well, and it's worth mentioning too about that song in particular. It's also very like 80s synthy, but not, in, a
synth
not in a corny way. Not in a corny way.
Dude, we'll talk. Well, whatever.
That contributes to the drama, which is not always the case with synthesizers.
But you and I both picked out a couple of notes and chords in there
yeah.
that were still very Mike Rutherford and Tony Banks.
Very, yeah. There was at some point there was like a suspended chord. It was like, oh my god, it sounds like the transition chord in Tonight, Tonight, Tonight. Like,
yeah,
yeah,
so. Yeah. Anyway,
but,
so that
but
was
good song, disturbing song.
Also that, yeah. Former
that everybody forgets about they when they think about Phil Collins like from the 80s, they think Sussudio, but they don't think about like this fucking like you're my wife and I'm gonna beat you in the head like kind of songs.
Oh
like,
yeah.
Or kill you and throw you in a lake songs.
Yeah. So anyway.
He may
yeah,
have been a little overexposed at some point.
This one, you know, love letter to the red light district. So there's
fantastic.
That.
Well, that was a good one, Kevin. That was a really good one. I will actually listen to that song again.
All right, kids, let's get back into it.
So years after the fact, after Peter Gabriel left the band, and we're back to talking about the Genesis record, Foxtrot, if you're keeping score at home. I don't even know how that would work, but if you are, you can. Gabriel, and it's interesting to me, Peter Gabriel and Genesis reunited only once, and it was on October 22nd, 1982, at the National Bowl in Milton Keynes, Buckinghamshire, England, Peter Gabriel put on the WOMAD Festival, the World of Music, Arts, and Dance. Mm-hmm. He was backed by Genesis's touring band, which had a couple of different members in it. And anyway, I didn't realize that, of course, it's not on the record we're talking about tonight, just a weird little sidebar. I didn't realize that Salisbury Hill was about him leaving the band.
I didn't know that it was. But I did want to bring up that Peter Gabriel got a lot better. After this worked out for everybody.
You were correct. It did.
Yeah, it really did. Anyway, but I also did want to talk about movement 1 and 4 specifically. In I'm having supper, or supper's ready, or somebody bring me some
dong,
supper
bell,
my notes.
Yeah,
supper's on.
I like that movement 4 is called "How Dare I Be So Beautiful," because I often feel that way myself.
What was that commercial in the 80s where like a really hot chick is like, don't hate me because
I'm beautiful.
I kind of do.
That was the chick that was in...
I hate you for saying that.
She was in Weird Science. I can't remember.
Oh, Kelly LeBrock?
Yeah.
Kelly
LeBrock. She was briefly married to Steven... what's his nuts? That's
Seagal, the guy built like a relief pitcher.
What's his nuts?
Yeah.
Yeah, but Kevin got it immediately. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Seagal, that dude, that fucking guy.
The guy with all the 3-word movie titles.
Yeah. Rest in pieces.
He's just a cook, everybody. Anyway, we're back to talking about Foxtrot. And first of all, before we go any further, let me just say again, thanks, Mark.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. You're welcome.
I will say this, in this setting tonight, as we have listened to a couple of tracks, I have been less ambivalent toward this record in this room than I was when I was listening to it on my own. And I don't know if it's just, maybe there's just better sound in here.
So
maybe
less ambivalent.
I have the time now. I don't know what it is.
Are you saying less ambivalent? You like it more, or
no? Well, I don't. I dislike it less.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah.
I just remember. Telling somebody at work, man, I gotta go fucking listen to this thing, and I already listened to a little bit of it at that point, and I pretty much decided I wasn't gonna be all about it. But anyway, he was like, "Oh, what's your podcast about?" So I kind of gave him the elevator pitch or whatever, and I was like, "But it's actually as much fun to talk about a record that I can't stand as it is, something that I just want to gush about for an hour." So,
yeah, well, I mean, and it's easy. We've talked about this ad nauseum on this show 1,000 times that, it's harder. Sometimes it's harder when we all agree, but when we all agree that a record is meandering and old and bad, and in this case, I don't know if we agree that it's just
meandering and old and bad.
I will say this. I don't think it's necessarily aged great.
It's not capital B bad, but it's all three things you said.
Yeah.
It's if a 3-year-old, had musical talent and could write a record. Because they're on the same thing for, just a little bit, and then all of a sudden it's like, hey, shiny bike.
I have a great appreciation for this album. I'm not going to say that I love it. Mm-hmm. I would have thought, when I picked it, I would have thought that it's one of those, it's a very polarizing type of album. You're going to find people that either think that this is one of the greatest things that Genesis put out, or you're going to find kind of the consensus that we have in this room where it's meandering and it's kind of a pile.
Well, I will say that I remember the one other positive thing I was going to say about it is they were ambitious.
Very.
They just threw it out there and here's what fuck we're doing.
I get what you're saying. This album, Mark, gets to a it gets to a place that I've never, it makes me feel something I've never felt before on this show, which is I felt extreme love and extreme hatred. I felt extreme ambivalence, but I've never
confusion.
I've never felt confusion like this before. I'm so confused.
Is
by
it, a,
it?
Is it a record?
I don't.
What
I can't
doing?
Like it or dislike it. It's almost like if like my cat like came up with a language and was talking that language to me, and I'd be like,
"Gross." I don't like, kind of fascinated, but
right.
Yeah.
You know, in a sense, not the music wise, but like trying to figure out what the song titles are.
Yeah. I'll, sure.
Right. The way that I feel. That's how I kind of feel about this record. That's right. A great way to put it.
Years ago,
this is like years. So you're this so already you're like in Tolkien right now. Like years ago,
when dragons ruled the land.
This is such it's a stupid story, and I won't tell all of it. But I'll just give you the weird context that I'm feeling right now. Years ago, I used to work for a company that made a pretty well known app or web product. And years ago, I was at like a recruiting thing, and there was a guy who came up to the like the co-founder of this company who happened to be in town for this thing, and he was dressed like in a like a full length like Neo jacket, like the Keanu Reeves character for The Matrix, and he had written his own code, like he had his own programming language, and he was just pitching it to the guy who co-founded this already successful existing website, and that was his pitch, was like, you should use my cockamamie language. That's kind of what I feel like this record is like sometimes. It's like some crazy guy who just wandered in out of the cold and won't pipe down.
Well, you never know, man. That could have been like the next like dominant language. You know, the founder, like Larry and Sergey, like pitched Google to like all the other major web companies at the time. They all turned them down. They're like, I guess we'll just start our own thing.
Well, and it's I don't think it would be fair to portray this as having fallen on deaf ears though in 1972. This was like, I mean, we've read some reviews from back then, but I mean this definitely inspired a lot of follow-up music.
Sure, Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman and Howe, well, and King Crimson, I guess, which yes. might have been the precursor to this actually.
Yeah, Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
That's a lot of
incestuous. That's a lot of contemporaries.
You know what is fascinating to me, by the way? Can we just? I'm looking like beyond you, Mark. At the every movement has their own like things, and then there's like the little sub, it like parenthetical titles of the songs.
Yeah.
Can we just read what the parenthetical titles are for each movement on this last song, or? I guess the ones
it's,
that
yeah, it's okay, really so, just the last
okay,
two
so
movements.
The, okay, so. It's movement 6, Apocalypse in 9-8, parenthetically, co-starring the delicious talents of Gabble Ratchet.
Is it Ratchet or Riche?
Riche, I suppose.
No, they're in England.
I was going to say they're England, so yeah. I was going to make a joke with
Ratchet
him.
Ratchet it is.
Well, that is a reference to the Hounds of Hell,
okay.
Shane,
sounds,
which are usually portrayed as geese.
Gabble Ratchet? Yes. Okay, so movement 7, as sure as eggs is eggs, in parentheses, aching men's feet.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. You're
correct.
That was I read that and I think about, we have a friend of the show, Mr. Mike Stevens, who occasionally will drop me a line, likes to post things to Twitter that say the random headline generator is broken. Like, that's what that feels like. I don't know.
As sure as eggs is, aching men's feet.
Sure.
Well, why don't we go ahead and play Apocalypse in 9-8. Let's play a little snip from that, which, Shane, you've already kind of mentioned that the drums on this weren't your bag, but
no, they're just it's just fascinating to me. Like, I
so love
it. Makes me feel
it's
like
gotta
I'm
be hard to drum in a 9-8 time signature.
Sure,
I just, love alternate time signatures, and I love the way that they put
I do
this
too.
Together.
But this gets a little bit like it gets a little it makes me feel like I'm getting off of a plane without like you know popping my ears, kind
sure,
of like you know, oh, what
disoriented.
Well, let's see if listeners at home can feel the same way. The gods of me, go, go, go. So the program that was handed out when Genesis would perform this live, in Peter Gabriel's words on that cut we just heard, at one whistle, the lovers become seeds in the soil, where they recognize other seeds to be people from the world in which they had originated. While they wait for spring, they are returned to their old world to see Apocalypse of St. John in full progress. The seven trumpeters cause a sensation. The fox keeps throwing sixes, and Pythagoras, a Greek extra, is deliriously happy as he manages to put exactly the right amount of milk and honey on his cornflakes.
Oh my fucking God. There's just nothing to like about that.
Right? No. Are you kidding me? The right amount of shit, honey and whatever on his cornflakes? Like, yeah, that's to like. But prior to that, yeah.
Seriously.
So then he talked about cereal because then you woke up and it's time to get breakfast.
Oh, there you go.
That could be it. Yeah, like, man, that was a really fucking weird dream. Like, and then you immediately forget it.
What the hell? What the hell? That's kind of like I think that would probably, like, if I were like the quote on like a movie poster that was about this record, you know, my quote would be like, "What the hell, Shane Bartel?"
Yeah, the fuck.
Ryan Newsom,
get a picture of me with it.
Well, I think we can. I think we can cut it there. I think
put that one to bed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. I want to hear a lot of like keyboard noodling. That's Apocalypse 98. Yeah.
I feel like if you're into prog rock or predisposed to be into prog rock, it's not an offensive record by any stretch of the imagination. It's very confusing for one that doesn't have any inclination to listen. But if you are predisposed to like stuff like this, you probably will like this.
You know, here's the difference, and I brought this up briefly when I mentioned this last week, this picking this album. I had a brother who was 5 years older. I still do have a brother that was 5 years older than me.
Yeah,
this is, it'd be weird if he were like for the rest of your life. I thought you were going to say just 5 years old.
Gaining on him,
Benjamin Button thing.
But I guess the point is that this is the music, not necessarily just this. You know, there was King Crimson, there was ELP, but this is the music that's coming out of my brother's door when I'm starting to get into music. So
did it smell like a reefer in there?
No, it did not. Actually,
were you living in the Switzerland at that time?
No, I was not living in Switzerland at the time. I guess the point is that I think that generationally, I think we all kind of missed this. You know,
I don't know if I missed it, Bob.
No, I think Mark's right. Generationally, we did. But however, there are things from other generations that we didn't miss. And I think, you know, for whatever reason, that might be like a 4-4 backbeat. This is a conversation for another time. But rock and roll, jazz, the Beatles, whatever. There's still
plenty
like
of stuff that, yeah.
There's a groove.
Like the Beatles had
it.
Just broken up.
It's more in the ass, not in the head. And this is in the head a little bit more than in the... You understand what I'm saying?
I hear you.
It's not... But. Yeah, right. It's not... It, you know, it's not... I'm not saying like one thing or the other. I just think like, you know, it's... I think that's maybe why people are more into certain kinds of classical music more than like weird stuff that's playing with time signatures and all over the place and stuff like that. Like, there is definitely audience for that.
I like hooks, and there aren't any on this record. Like, that's fine.
There aren't any. That's true. But there's an audience for this kind of music. This isn't bad. This
ultimately. No, you're not a bad person if you like it. I just don't want to hang out with you.
All right, who's cleaning up tonight?
Zingers.
Ryan.
Yeah, so this week, Current Affair, new song. What have you? I was just exposed to this a couple weeks ago on Saturday Night Live. It's a young artist named Troy Sivan with a song called The Good Side.
I got the good side of things, left you with both of the rings. My fingers danced and swayed in the breeze. The change in the wind took you down to your knees. I got the good side of you, sent it out into the blue. The
The people danced to the sound of your heart. The world sang along to it falling apart. But I sympathize and I recognize. Baby, I apologize that I got the good side. The good side of things.
So I'm not surprised to hear all the chatter around the room. Mark's all like, a little bit of Johnny Marr there. And Shane's like, no, it's a Smith thing. And specifically, it's Please, Please, Please.
Yeah, it's Please, Please, Please. Yeah.
It's Please, Please, Please meets Into the Dark.
No, but
Death
there's...
Death Cab for Cutie.
Yeah. No, but it's great. I mean, the song
fantastic.
Is great. It's beautiful. Yeah.
By the way, when you guys are watching that, we watched the SNL clip of this, and I assume that Mark will link it when we publish all this, but you know, you guys notice that the guy in the percussion in the back had a little bit of a Ringo Starr thing going on? I really expected him to go, peace and love, peace and love.
And your octopus is gone.
Right, exactly. But yeah, no, very, very lilting track, if you would.
I liked it. I liked it the first time I heard it. I liked it more this time that I heard it. There's even more than that. There's Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now a little bit in there, like toward the end of it, like her piano stuff. It's mm-hmm. a Smith.
No, he's obviously a fan. To me, it was Please, Please, Please meets Into the Dark by Death Cab.
Yeah, No, but it's good too. I mean, he's got his own thing going on too.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it derivative, but he's definitely got influences.
Everybody said Johnny Marr quoted it, but he wasn't the first person that did. Like, you know, like everybody steals. You know, like
mm-hmm. music is collaborative.
Well, so it happens like just once or twice per season. I watch every episode of Saturday Night Live, and I give each musical act in each song. Like 30 seconds. To
30
seconds.
I was going to say
30 seconds to
win
me
over.
Can't
be more than a minute.
And yeah, I TiVo the thing. So like I give them 30 seconds. If they got me within 30 seconds, and the first song this dude played, I was like, eh.
Yeah, you know? It was pretty eh.
Yeah, and like most of the time, the acts they have on these days, like I've never heard of, and they're playing kind of...
Oh my God, Dad. Never heard of them.
Well,
but,
I know, so. But they play kind of synthy pop stuff or whatever, and the first one was kind of like that, and then I got into this... fully preparing to just be bored to tears, and I was not. I was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, good song.
Yeah, I looked him up, and apparently he's wildly popular. Again, with the old guy thing, but whatever. Yep. Like, good on him. May he sally forth and have a prosperous career.
I'm happy to see you. I'm happy to... You know, it makes me so happy to have you... He's so, what word am I looking for here? Like, benevolent.
That's right. I'm just looking out for the kids.
The kids. You know, I've been reading a lot of Dan Savage lately. He says, as the kids say, and I'm like, you know, when people say, as the kids say, you're never going to sound more old or annoying as...
Well, he knows that. He's like 52.
Yeah, but he... Anyway, this is a conversation for a different show.
Speaking of a different show, you have next week, Shane?
Yes.
What you got for us?
Portishead 3?
Yeah. I'm kind of surprised we have never gotten around to covering Portishead
before. That's exactly what I thought today when I was thinking about it.
Yeah, no, fine work, sir. Like, we haven't even covered it yet. I'm already happy.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, a little maudlin.
There is a little bit of maudlin with Portishead. Yep.
So, yeah.
Cool.
All right. Well, I guess until next week, I'm Kevin.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Shane.
I'm Mark.
This is Somebody Likes It.
You don't know what...